Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter. A warm welcome to our listeners. Thank you for joining us today. For those who have been with the podcast from the beginning, you may remember that for the very first episode in February 2019, we asked the question, what role can and should the United Nations Security Council play on tackling the security risks that emerge from a changing climate? We're excited to once again focus on the role of the UNSC for our final episode of 2022. Until now, the discourse around climate-related insecurity in the Security Council has been focused on how the effects of climate change exacerbate insecurity on regional, national, and international levels. On the 29th of November, Kenya and Norway held a UNSC meeting on climate, peace, and security that aimed to broaden the UNSC's awareness of how climate security and peace building interact in order to offer a basis for additional tools and entry points to better achieve its mandate. Today, we are very lucky to be joined by one of the panel discussants, Hafsa Malim. She's a research fellow at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, a specialist in peace and security with a background in international law, who has worked with the African Union Commission's Office of the Commissioner, Department of Political Affairs, Peace and Security, and International IDEA. Welcome, Hafsa.
Thank you, Alexandra.
Hi, Hafsa. Also welcome from my side. Yeah, let's get started maybe with some background for our listeners. So my first question to you is, up to this point, what would you say have been some of the obstacles to get climate, peace, and security on the agenda at the UN Security Council?
Well, thank you, Raquel, and thank you, Alexandra, first for having me to join you in this last discussion of the year. I think just to dive into it, I would not necessarily phrase the discussion or the discourse on climate, peace and security at the UN Security Council as an obstacle, i.e. an obstacle in placing it on the agenda. On the contrary, the Security Council has debated this since 2007 with the UK tabling this. Between 2011, we saw this discussion emerging severally, especially on country-specific debates on the Lake Chad Basin or in Darfur and Mali, and regional debates as well, also in the Sahel and Lake Chad, as I had said. Between 2019 and 2022, we saw this debate picking up more, with the thematic discussion being focused on at least 10 times, both in the form of the ARIA formula and also in high-level debates. In a sense, there seems to be an appreciation at the UN Security Council level that there's a need for this discussion. And the statements, as you rightly pointed, in the ARIA formula meeting that Kenya and Norway organized, a number of the member states did have quite statements that aligned quite a lot, recognizing that this issue, one, is pertinent for the UN Security Council to be seized of, but it's also that it is complex, interlinked, and it does have an impact on international, regional, and national security, but also on human security. What we saw the challenge more, and now coming back to your point on the obstacle, is despite the nuances of appreciation or the appreciation that this issue needs to be discussed at a Security Council level or needs to be discussed from the point of peace and security through the adoption of presidential statements, but through also the numerous statements that are made by the member states, what we have not seen is a commitment in a form of perhaps a resolution. There have been several attempts in the last 2 years to get this, or two attempts actually to be specific, and we saw both of them not working out. But what we have, and I try to look at this as a glass half full, is we do have some substantial language and so sort of awareness that we can be able to capitalize on. And I use we as the climate change, peace and security, climate, peace and security practitioners, policymakers, and also academics, so thinkers who are also in this field. So there's quite a bit in terms of traction that we can be able to make use of, and we can be able to use to implement or take the discussion further.
Perfect. Looking at last month's meeting, you shared insights from the African continent on how the discussion on climate peace and security has evolved specifically within the continent and trends on what lessons can be drawn. And like you've already mentioned a bit there, you also emphasized the interlinkages between climate change and conflict, and that they're complex, nonlinear, compounding, as well as cascading. So what is the impact of this on the capacity of institutions like the African Union and the United Nations itself in making, keeping, and building peace?
You've captured it well. First on the African continent, and I'd like to build from the region now, focusing more on the global level. The evolution of the language and policy when it comes to the discussion on climate, peace, and security has largely been informed not just by the impact that climate change has on the peace and security landscape on the continent, the fact that it seems to be exacerbating already fragile security settings or fragile peace, but it's also being informed by the need for the institution, in this case, the AU and the regional economic communities, to better respond, to better adapt to these emerging challenges. And this is how we've seen some interesting shift also, not just looking at climate change as a threat multiplier, but also as a development issue. It's also a human security issue. And so that evolution in itself is a recognition that institutions also are adapting in responding or creating adaptive policies that can better respond to the interconnected nature of these risks. So in a sense, you've captured it, which is that, yes, the interlinkages or the effect that climate change has on building peace and in keeping peace is hampering the institution's effectiveness in responding to some of the challenges on the ground. On the human front, I think what we have seen, especially in mission settings, is that the need to respond more effectively, more comprehensively, is also being recognized more and more. This is how we have seen the climate security advisors that are then embedded into the missions, for example, in UNSOM, and more recruitments that are currently ongoing in other mission settings. And the idea is to create or to provide the mission with a capacity to be able to make their peace engagements more climate sensitive and to be more aware of the dynamics, the climate and environmental dynamics, so that they can be able to create a respond programming better. So that in itself is a step in the right direction, but more needs to be done. And what one of the messages that was emanating from the Security Council throughout this year is that this program in itself and other similar initiatives like the creation of the UN Climate Security Mechanism, shared mandate between DPPA, UNEP and UNDP, is a step in the right direction in trying to mainstream these engagements. But more needs to be done. And what is the more that was emanating from the debate is that these missions, for example, have implied mandates, but they need to be given explicit mandates so that they can be able to engage better. And this would then allow for these programs to be better resourced and to also create some more sustainability. Having one advisor embedded in a program is just not sufficient. We need to have some foresight. There needs to be foresight in sort of in the engagement, in the creation rather, I wouldn't say engagement here, of these programs and how they're run.
Thank you. And speaking of more needing to be done, we know that climate change affects people differently and it does make a difference. What is your economic background, your ethnicity, your gender? This is well established by now. How would you say inclusivity plays a role in the climate peace and security programming? So in other words, how can inclusivity help to ensure that information like early warnings, which are so important, right, in the context of climate change, how can they get to those most impacted? And also that well-intentioned initiatives, they actually meet the needs of these communities.
Well, you've captured it well again. I mean, the concept of inclusivity is very important. What we don't want to see is climate peace and security programming being created at the upper echelons of policymaking, but then being implemented at a grassroots level, but being disconnected at the same time from the needs of the community. And I'm glad that you mentioned early warning, because this is one of the most important sort of routes of trying to ensure that we bridge the gap between the needs of the community and also the conversation that is happening at a policy level. Gathering information at the ground will better inform the policies that are being created. I can give you some examples of early warning systems that are already doing that, and I like to refer mostly to what the African Union is doing with the Continental Early Warning System, what IGAD is doing with C1, what, for example, ECOWAS, the economic community, is doing with WANEP on the ground. where as much as these systems tend to be largely conflict early warning systems, they tend to take into account a more nuanced, I would say, understanding of what root causes of conflict. This also includes education, climate change, healthcare, environmental issues. And what they're doing now in terms of not just monitoring secondary data is they're also monitoring primary data, or they're gathering primary data. And from this, what we have seen is they're getting information from the ground. Of course, there's a lot of process of triangulation and editing the data. But this is then being used to inform some of the reports, which are then used to shape policies. And this makes the policies far more responsive and far more or better utility to the communities at hand. But the concept of inclusivity for me is to make sure that the diverse groups of people's needs are captured at any point in time. And I think this is where holistic early warning systems can be able to come in.
Yeah, perfect. I think you did really highlighting the need to gather information on the ground and really speaking to affected communities. So we've already highlighted a bit about the need for better data, more locally informed data. That's incredibly vital to things like early warning systems, as this has been a call from developing and least developed countries that are often the most affected by climate change. And when it comes to turning early warning systems and actually leading to early action, how can we build upon this momentum and actually make these systems work for the communities that need them?
Well, the biggest challenge when it comes to early warning, whether you're talking about climate early warning systems, DRRs, or whether you're talking about conflict early warning systems, the biggest challenge is trying to prove prevention, perhaps less on the climate side, because you can be able to actually see when you're able to respond to a cyclone, for example, or you forewarn a drought. And by extent, what happens is investment in early warning is expensive. There's a lot of technology equipment that is needed. And there seems to be donors or development partners and actors generally just tend to shy away from investing heavily in early warning because there's little evidence of the prevention or how useful or utility of early warning, I would think, is what I would say. However, investment in early warning, even though it may look expensive at hand, is actually much cheaper than responding to some of these challenges that emerge. The second biggest issue when it comes to issues of early warning is response is largely a political issue and it's owned at a completely different level. While you may have early warning that is emerging from a continental or sort of regional level, there's little response that can be done at that level. There's programming that can support, but majority of the response largely lies at a national level. And this requires political will, it requires resources, and I say resources both in terms of financial and human resource, which sometimes some of these member states may not necessarily have. At the end of the day, there's competing interests. In some cases, perhaps far more complex security situations. In the case of the last 2 years, the pandemic has been on the forefront in terms of priority and investment for most member states. So in that sense, it becomes a bit more challenging to fully or perhaps more holistically translate early warning into early response. But there's still room. And I think this is where partnership is key. When it comes to responding to issues of climate change, we may have, for example, climate change and its impact on security. Let me be specific here. We may have an understanding or a shared understanding as to what the threats are. But when it comes to responses, we need to be able to curate these responses together as well, taking advantage of the different institutions' capacities at any point in time. So development actors can take the lead on development engagement issue policy, and political institutions can sort of spearhead the political landscape. So there's a lot to be done, but more importantly, it cannot be done without robust partnership.
Yeah, so you just mentioned partnerships and responses as well, which ties well with the question I wanted to ask you next. During the Security Council meeting, you've also highlighted the Climate Responses for Sustaining Peace initiative, as well as the Climate for Peace initiative, which was launched at the BCSC and also presented at COP27. There are a few initiatives out there. They're seeking to synthesize all the knowledge that's being generated and transform it into workable concepts that also speak directly to policymakers. Now, what role do you see for this kind of multilateral joint initiatives in actually furthering the climate security agenda internationally?
What I found most interesting about especially the two initiatives that you mentioned, the Climate Response for Sustaining Peace and the Climate for Peace initiative, is I see them as perhaps the next step in the broader discussion of climate change, peace and security. Just recalling the conversation that we've had at the start of this podcast, which is that we have seen significant progress in the policy front. Perhaps we may not have gotten to where we wanted. Maybe what we were pushing for as a community more is a resolution. But we have seen an evolution in language. We've seen perhaps some more acceptance on that level. But what next? What do we do next with that kind of language? How do we ensure that that momentum at the political level is then translated into concrete initiatives? And this is how I see some of these engagements is now that we have a conceptual understanding of what, or starting to have a conceptual understanding of what these linkages are, how do we then make sure that the programming is far more responsive as well to the challenges that we highlight? And I think this is what I find most interesting, the idea of looking at investments in adaptation, for example, not just as a development issue, but as a peace-building issue, which is something that the community, I think the climate change community has been calling on for the longest time, because we've been having the conversations in silos, whether you're talking about issues of climate change or security, in two completely different bubbles. But now with this kind of initiatives, then we have some commonalities that are able to also influence the programming, not just the policy discussion. So I think it's much needed. I think it's also a platform that is creating room for like-minded thinkers or like-minded actors to be able to come together and push for the implementation phase of this discussion. So it's quite an interesting engagement for it to come actually to emanate at the COP, but also around the COP to also be some ambition that is a launch pad for some things that we can be able to do in the coming years.
Speaking of kind of the next steps in the climate, peace and security debate, as well as some of these new initiatives being a launching pad for future conversations, future momentum and future progress. This is, of course, the last podcast episode of 2022. So 2023 is just around the corner, which means a new year for roughly half of the world's population or so. And as humans, we often tend to look at new years as new opportunities, as if we have a new chance to finally get things right. So coming from this perspective of hope, which steps would you like to see being taken by the international community in terms of addressing the risks to human security stemming from climate change in the upcoming year?
What I would hope to see from the international community is, one, an amplification of the discussion on climate change, peace and security. As we have said, a lot has been accomplished. The conversation has, in the last especially 3 or so years, completely taken a different turn, but we've seen more synergy in terms of more actors coming to appreciate the complexity of the issue, the interconnected nature of the issue. We have seen the think tank, academia, rolling out more think pieces and more analytical pieces to basically further the conversation to show us what exactly are the links and what does it mean for our engagements in peace and security. So we're no longer arguing that there is no evidence. We're no longer arguing that these issues are not linked. That is very clear. So what I would like to see on that front, on the policy front, is now that we are aware, how do we amplify that? How do we take that to the next level? And I see that through three main lenses. One is these issues of financing, adaptation and mitigation. And I'd like to maybe also closely link this to the debate at the Security Council. Some of the language or some of the discussion that is emanating from the Security Council, from the climate, peace and security skeptics, from those who feel that the UN Security Council perhaps is not the right platform to have this conversation, they argue that not only is it a platform, but also the best way to respond to climate change issues is not to have a conversation on the linkages alone, but for member states or for partners to be able to implement their commitments to the Paris Agreement. And there's some merit to this argument, which is to say that in addition to us being seized of the policy discourse, for in us being seized to the sort of the linkages of between climate change and security, we should not do that alone, or we should not do that in a silo. Then that needs to go hand in hand with the continued implementation of the commitments that have already been made. Second is building momentum around good progress that has been made around the COP. This is on the adoption of the Loss and Damage Fund. I mean, a step in the right direction. I'm sure the modalities are still being worked out. But I think what is most crucial, and I think organizations like the Climate Change Foundation are arguing quite heavily, is this issue of the additionality principle, making sure that the resourcing of the Loss and Damage Fund, the resourcing of adaptation, is not necessarily a redirection of funding that were earmarked for other things, but to make sure that it is not being funded at the detriment of other development programs that are also very core or very crucial. Because then what we don't want to see is then in a couple of years, we come back and we realize there are gaps that need to be then met. And I think lastly, is this issue of transition. It's very important that we're having a conversation on green transitions and to have a discussion what exactly that could mean. But as we are heavily debating and pushing for transitions, I think these transitions need to be most importantly just and peaceful. And an argument I would like to share here is this backdraft argument that the Environment for Peace report brings out quite heavily. And this is to ensure that the transitions are not harming the communities, that we need to ensure that the community's interests are protected at any point in time, but the environment is also protected. So as there's a rush for these extractives that are necessary for transitions, and those two principles must be met, which is to ensure that the communities and environmental sort of protection are put at the core of any sort of engagement around transitions. So I think these would be the three key things I would like to see a bit more, especially being discussed a bit more by the international community and in policy spaces in the coming year.
Thank you so much, especially for those three insights and some key things that the community should keep an eye out on for 2023 and even more years to come. We're starting to get to the end of our conversation. Is there anything else that you want to highlight about the debate from the last year or any of the key highlights or key moments from your perspective?
I think just to reflect on one of the statements that was made at the Security Council and to perhaps paraphrase one of the statements is to say that whilst we're having a conversation as to what exactly the scientific evidence between climate change and peace and security are at the policy level, it's a lived reality for most communities, especially here on the African continent. So this idea that we perhaps need more data to be able to make more informed decisions is not a reflective of the reality on the ground. And this is why in my statement, I started off by reflecting on real examples, borrowing from Mozambique, from Somalia, from Sudan, from Mali, Chad, just reflecting on what that engagement actually looks like or what those linkages actually look like. So it's to just emphasize as we're ending the year that has been very heavy on the discussion of climate, peace and security, a year where Africa has held the COP in Sharm el-Sheikh just earlier this year, is to say that there's a reason why this conversation was brought to the scope and level it was, which is that it's a lived reality for this continent. And moving on to the next year is we hope that we'll not see a regression. What we will see is implementation of all the commitments that have been made and that the communities on this continent can be able to benefit from the policy discussions.
Thank you so much. I think it's been an exciting conversation to look back on some of the evolution of the language that's used regarding climate change, peace, and security, and looking back when the conversation was first starting and how it focused on the effects of climate change, exacerbating insecurity on regional, national, international levels, and now how that understanding is being broadened in order to allow for better tools, better entry points for bodies like the UNSC to achieve its mandate, and really focusing on these complex, compounding, cascading interlinkages. And of course, we need to make sure that we leverage the shared understanding that's coming into more prominence in order to leverage partnerships with some of the key things like the Climate for Peace Initiative and different outcomes from COP and loss and damages, and really make sure that in the year to come, we don't see a regression, but we listen to the lived realities for different communities, listen to people living in these circumstances, and make sure that we better center these things as we move forward. So thank you so much for joining us for this podcast.
And yes, thank you so much. It was very good.
So this was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We will be back for another episode in the new year, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you can follow our latest updates on Twitter @ClimateDiplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy holidays, everyone.